The Oracle Network.
Look deeper. Well, hey there, friends. Welcome back. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson. Happy Wednesday, happy hump day, happy October. I hope you're all doing well and that you've recovered enough from last week's episode because, boy, do I have a doozy for you today. Today we're going to have a little chat about Peter Curtin, the vampire of Dusseldorf. In keeping with my Halloween vampire theme for October, I thought it seemed appropriate to fly across the Atlantic to Germany and see how their vampire compares to the one in the States. And I'm just being honest, right from the get-go, just seeing a picture of Peter Curtin is enough to unsettle me. There's something about his eyes. They look lifeless, but again, my imagination tends to run away with itself, so I can also picture what his face warped into and what it looked like in the midst of a murderous rage, and it's terrifying, and I hate that that's how my mind works sometimes, but that's what it is, so here we go. Although Curtin didn't begin actively murdering people until he was 30, he claimed to have had a hand in the unfortunate drownings of two schoolmates when he was just 9 years old. Curtin's childhood was atrocious, to say the least. His alcoholic father was a sadist who brutalized his entire family on a daily basis. His wife and his 13 children were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused, and as for Peter, being the oldest meant he endured more than his younger siblings. By the time he was 9, Peter's emotional and sexual development were so railroaded by his father's abuse that he entered into another equally unhealthy relationship with a neighbor in his building who introduced him to bestiality. This eventually escalated to Curtin discovering that he could obtain the highest pleasure imaginable by inflicting further acts of violence on the animal as he sodomized them. Curtin would eventually be arrested for the horrific rapes and murders of at least 9 people, including several children, as well as 7 attempted murders. However, his capture was actually instigated by Curtin himself, who realized it was only a matter of time before he would be caught after police discovered the identity of the man who raped a woman named Maria Budlick. When he confessed to his wife that he was the vampire of Dusseldorf, and to ensure that she would be financially taken care of after his arrest, he insisted that she be the one to turn him in and collect the reward money. Not having much of a choice, Frau Curtin brought the police to her husband, and Peter Curtin gave himself up on May 24th, 1930. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Where, oh where, do I begin with Peter Curtin? Frankly, this one might be the most terrifying case I've covered so far because it is completely horrible the whole way, right up through his execution by guillotine. Would you like to know what he asked the prison psychiatrist about his pending execution? He posed this question, quote, "Tell me, after my head has been chopped off, will I still be able to hear, at least for a moment, the sound of my own blood gushing from the stump of my neck," end quote. And when the psychiatrist told him that it'd be likely that his ears would still function for a few seconds after the guillotine struck, Peter Curtin said, quote, "That would be the pleasure to end all pleasures," end quote. So that's the kind of man we're going to be discussing today. Can you tell that I'm delaying a little bit? Usually I just jump right into it, but he makes me squeamish. But there's no point in delaying the inevitable. This is why we're all here. So, as always, my friends, we will start at the beginning because Curtin's childhood is paramount to understanding the kind of person he would end up being. He was born on May 26th, 1883, the oldest of what would end up being 13 children in the Curtin family. His family was extremely poor, and they all lived in a one-bedroom apartment that they rented in Cologne, Germany. Peter's father was a molder and had a severe drinking problem. His father would go to work and then straight to the pub, and then he would burst through the door, intoxicated and rage-filled, to conclude the night by beating his children, with Peter often taking the brunt of it as the oldest, as he attempted to shield his siblings from his father's fury. His father would then force their mother to strip naked in front of the children and make them watch as he raped his wife. As the years passed and Curtin's sisters matured, their father would also rape them. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind, or really anyone's for that matter, that being beaten and exposed to violent physical and sexual assaults had a perilously damaging effect on Curtin and his development. To see violence, sexual and otherwise, as a regular, albeit terrifying, occurrence in your home can force a child's emotional intelligence to be infected with depravity. If all a child sees is violence, then this is what they know and what they associate with relationships. And in Curtin's case, this is exactly what happened, because unfortunately, in Germany, in the late 1800s, there was zero chance for an abused wife to leave her husband. His mother had nowhere to go, no one to turn to for help, so for years she endured the unimaginable and watched her children go through years and years of a brutal existence. By the time he was 9 years old, Peter's emotional development was so warped that he began an inappropriate relationship with a dog catcher who also lived in the same building. This much older man would catch dogs and torture them, eventually convincing Peter to join in. The dog catcher also, quote, introduced him to the practice of bestiality carried out initially on dogs, end quote. Around this age, Peter allegedly murdered two of his friends from school. They were all swimming in the Rhine, taking turns jumping into the water off a raft, when Peter suddenly pushed one of his friends into the water, and when the other boy jumped in to help him, Peter waited until they got close enough to the raft, and then he reached down and held them underwater until they drowned. At the time, no one suspected that it was anything more than a tragic accident, and Peter was never blamed or suspected for their deaths. For years, he continued to endure the abuse from his father and the psychological damage that it inflicted. His sexual development became more and more depraved. Quote, his bestiality extended to sheep, goats, and other farmyard animals, with the teenager discovering particular pleasure when the animal was stabbed during intercourse, end quote. As he grew older, the abuse became more and more unbearable, to the point where Peter ran away for a few days or even weeks at a time more than once. His time spent on the streets introduced him to a world of petty crime, and in 1899, Peter turned 16 years old and decided enough was enough and got the hell out of there. Not long after he ran away, his father was actually arrested and sentenced to 3 years in jail for raping Peter's 13-year-old sister. Several of the sources I have say, quote, incestuous relations. But I have a problem with that wording, because it's not a relation, it's not a relationship. It's a 13-year-old girl who was betrayed and abused by her deadbeat, alcoholic, pedophile rapist of a father. It's incest and it's rape, plain and simple, and there's no point in beating around the bush. Around this same time, Peter's mother was also granted a separation order, so she was able to separate from her husband and be legally no longer connected to him. She eventually remarried and moved to Dusseldorf. Peter continued to commit various misdemeanors, stealing food and clothing to survive. Some of these landed him in jail, but never for very long. He also tried to rape the same sister that his father was put in prison for raping. Each time that he was put behind bars, he became more and more enraged at society. He later claimed, quote, his brutal treatment in the penal system made him hell-bent on wreaking revenge on society, end quote. His sadistic tendencies turned from animals to humans, fantasizing about brutally violent sexual acts while he served his time in solitary confinement. The prisons were dismally kept up, and Curtin would do whatever he could to ensure that he spent the maximum amount of time possible in solitary confinement, as the silence and the isolation was able to further fuel and develop his sick, twisted fantasies. despite these violent fetishes and an extreme abhorrence towards society, Curtin was outwardly a charming, good-looking young man who was never without a lady admirer. But at this point, the damage had been done, and Curtin was incapable of feeling any kind of empathy or really any emotion other than hate for another person, let alone falling in love. His sociopathic charm lured women in, but the relationships never lasted. During the period he was in between prison sentences, Curtin began committing sexual assaults and robberies. But on May 25, 1913, the day before his 30th birthday, he committed his first murder, 10-year-old Christine Klein. The following morning, Klein was discovered strangled, raped, and stabbed in her bedroom, her attacker having slipped in and out undetected as her parents worked in the pub downstairs the night before. After Curtin's capture, he explained in extreme and explicit detail how he ended up in the bedroom of Christine Klein. Quote, "I broke into a house in the Wolfstrasse, an inn owned by Klein, and went up to the first floor. I opened different doors and found nothing worth stealing, but in the bed I saw a sleeping girl of about 10, covered with a thick feather bed. I had a small but sharp pocket knife with me, and I held the child's head and cut her throat. I heard the blood spurt and drip on the mat beside the bed. It spurted in an arch, right over my hand. The whole thing lasted about 3 minutes. Then I went and locked the door again and went back home to Dusseldorf," end quote. Suspicion immediately fell on the girl's uncle, a man named Otto. The previous night, Otto had asked his brother Peter Klein for a loan, but Peter refused. This led to an argument that ended with Otto telling her father that he'd do, quote, "something he would remember all his life," end quote, which is a pretty unfortunate choice of words to have said when your niece turns up murdered the following morning. Otto was charged with Christine's murder and went to trial, but he was not found guilty, and he was acquitted of the murder charge due to insufficient evidence. During the investigation and trial, Curtin reveled in the suffering he had caused the Klein family and followed the trial closely, watching another person's life be destroyed was sheer pleasure for him. Unfortunately, Christine's killer's real identity would remain unknown for nearly 18 years. The following year, Peter was drafted into Kaiser Wilhelm II's army ahead of the country's entrance into World War I, but shockingly, military life didn't suit someone like Peter Curtin, and not long after he enlisted, he went AWOL from his barracks. Eventually, he was captured and imprisoned for desertion until 1921. During his 7 years behind bars, the rage just seethed inside him. He believed he had been subjected to the most egregious injustice, and that once he was a free man again, the world would suffer for what it had done to him when the time was right. After his release, Curtin moved to Altenburg to stay with his sister, which is about 470 kilometers or a little under 300 miles from Cologne. There he met and married a former prostitute who had also done some jail time for the alleged shooting death of her fiancé, who supposedly left her at the altar. So it seems like these two were a match made in heaven, and for the next 4 years, Curtin and his wife lived a pretty normal life. He got a job as a molder, just like his father, but this peaceful existence would only last for so long. Whatever fury was brewing inside Curtin was slowly brimming to the surface, and he turned his eyes to Dusseldorf, which was close to his hometown of Cologne. So Curtin and his wife moved back to West Germany in 1925, and he fell back into petty crime and arson. One of his favorite sexual fantasies was, quote, imagining that a tramp was burning alive in a bard he had just torched, end quote. He soon escalated into violent attacks on unsuspecting women, often strangling them into unconsciousness during sex. Authorities suspect that he was responsible for at least 4 attacks until early 1929, including the stabbing assault of Maria Kuhn, who miraculously survived the 24 stab wounds inflicted by Curtin. On February 9, 1929, Curtin came across 9-year-old Rosa Oleiger as she walked down the street. He attacked and stabbed her 3 times, killing her before tossing her body under a bush and lighting her on fire to get rid of the evidence. After his capture, he, quote, later recalled having an orgasm at the height of the attack, end quote. Rose's murder would kick off a slew of attacks on young girls, women, and even a few men around Dusseldorf for the next 15 months. Less than a week after Curtin killed Rosa, he stabbed and killed a man named Scheer, a 45-year-old mechanic. Scheer, quote, had 20 knife wounds, including several to the head, end quote. After this murder, Curtin even returned to the scene of the crime, relishing in the moment, and even spoke to one of the detectives about the murder. Each attack committed by Peter Curtin was excessively covered in the German press, leaving no detail out and hyping up whatever would sell papers the fastest. When it was revealed that investigators believed the killer was drinking the blood of his victims, the press bestowed upon the unidentified killer the moniker the Vampire of Dusseldorf. In great need to find the person responsible, police believe the case was closed when a man named Stossberg was accused of similar crimes and admitted to all of the attacks attributed to the Vampire of Dusseldorf. Stossberg was developmentally disabled and likely didn't know what he was admitting to, but that didn't stop the police from committing him to an asylum and closing the book on the case. And I'm curious if this bothered Curtin at all. He definitely strikes me as the type who would hate for someone else to get credit for his kills. Or maybe, on the other hand, he was relieved that the suspicion wasn't anywhere close to him. Despite police thinking that they had the killer off the streets, multiple strangulations and murders occurred through 1929, including the horrific murders of 5-year-old Gertrude Hemmecker and 14-year-old Louise Lenzen, who were foster sisters. Their bodies were discovered at a fairground on August 23rd. Curtin had, quote, approached two foster sisters as they left the fair and asked the older one, Louise Lenzen, 14, to run an errand for him. "Would you be very kind and get some cigarettes for me? I'll look after the little girl," he said. Louise agreed, but as soon as she was out of sight, he strangled 5-year-old Gertrude Hemmecker and slit her throat. When Louise returned, she too was dragged off the path, strangled, and almost decapitated with Curtin's pocket knife, end quote. The day after the girls were found, Curtin attacked another woman, Gertrude Schulte, after trying to convince her to have sex with him. Thankfully, she survived and was able to provide police with a description of the man who attacked her, citing he was nice-looking and in his early 40s. At this point, Curtin showed no signs of slowing down. The attacks were occurring more and more frequently, each one sensationalized in the papers, causing widespread fear and panic. In September, Curtin raped and murdered Ida Reuter, and then on October 12, 1929, he beat Elizabeth Dorier to death. On October 25th, he attacked two other women with a hammer, but they were lucky to survive. Unfortunately, they couldn't provide specific details about their attacker. They knew he was tall and a white male, but that made it very difficult for police to narrow down their search. After each attack, Curtin would anxiously await the press coverage. He loved how terrified he had made the citizens of Dusseldorf. But reading about his crimes wasn't enough. Much like how he sometimes returned to the scene of the crime in order to relive the attacks, Curtin also contacted one of the newspapers on November 9th. He sent them a map, which alerted authorities to the whereabouts of 5-year-old Gertrude Albermann, who had gone missing 2 days earlier. Curtin had strangled and stabbed Gertrude at least 35 times with a pair of scissors before he dumped her body under a pile of building rubble. That cold, brutal Germany winter did nothing to slow Curtin's rage. He continued his attacks well into the spring of 1930, although thankfully, none of the attacks resulted in death. The survivors' stories did, however, give the press plenty to ramp up the terror. By this time, Germany was hit hard by the Great Depression. There were little pleasures in life but the newspapers. They provided an escape for those who were suffering economic disaster, and the longer the attacks went on, the more frustrated the people of Dusseldorf became with their law enforcement. They couldn't understand why the man responsible hadn't been caught yet, but Curtin's time was coming. On May 14, 1930, Curtin encountered a young woman who was having a verbal altercation with a man. The woman, Maria Budlick, was on her way to a boarding house, and she had asked a man for directions. This man offered to show her, but she became concerned when he wanted to take her on a shortcut. especially after reading about all of the horrific murders of the vampire of Dusseldorf, so she began to clamor for any excuse not to continue on with the man, but he was persistent. At this point, the heightened back and forth caught the attention of another man who stepped in and helped Maria. The rescuer was none other than Peter Curtin. Maria, relieved and grateful for his intervention, explained that she was out of work and had nowhere to go, so Curtin offered to let her stay at his apartment in Mettmannerstrasse. Maria was so thankful and followed the stranger to his home, but once they were inside, Maria again felt fear clutching at her throat as Curtin, who explained that his wife was away for the night, tried to initiate sex with her. She resisted and asked that he take her somewhere else, to which Curtin agreed. As he escorted Maria to the train station, they passed the Grafenberger Woods as he felt a familiar urge take over his body. Curtin then grabbed Maria by the hand and asked if he could have her before dragging her into the woods. She fought back with everything she had, but unfortunately she was no match for Curtin's strength as he violently raped her. Maria, fearing for her life, begged Curtin not to kill her. When he was later asked why he hadn't murdered the girl, Curtin said, quote, "I thought that under the circumstances she would agree, and my opinion was right. Afterwards, I took her back to the tram, but I did not accompany her right to it because I was afraid she might inform the police officer who was standing there. I had no intention of killing Budlick, as she had offered no resistance," end quote. When Curtin brought Maria to the train station, he didn't want anyone to see her being dropped off by him, and he was certain that Maria would have no way of remembering where his apartment was or who he was. He believed he had gotten away with it. Except Maria Budlick did remember. She remembered everything. Curtin's face, his address, the street he lived on, everything. Except she was frightened of reporting her attack in person. She didn't want to be further victimized, and she was terrified that her attacker would find her. So instead, she wrote the entire experience down in a letter to her friend, Frau Bruckner. Through fate, or just sheer accident, Maria's letter never made it to her friend. Instead, it ended up in the hands of a Frau Brugmann, who upon reading the contents of the letter, immediately called the police. Not long after, police tracked down Maria and asked her about the attack. Still in fear of another encounter with Curtin, Maria bravely put that aside and directed Chief Inspector Gnat to Curtin's home at 71 Mettmannerstrasse. At the police's urging, the landlady opened Curtin's room to find him not there. But as Maria looked around, she knew she was in the right place. The room belonged to Peter Curtin. As Maria and the inspector exited the room, Maria noticed a man walking up the stairs towards her. The man, with his hat pulled low, raised his eyes up and looked at her. Her heart stopped and she stood there paralyzed, staring at the face of the man who had attacked her. Peter Curtin, startled for just a moment, quickly walked down the hallway and slipped into his room without anyone else noticing. Maria, still too frightened to say anything, then watched as the vampire of Dusseldorf exited his room, walked out of the building past two plainclothes officers standing in the street, and disappeared into the night. When Curtin arrived at his home, he was greeted by his wife, and looking at her, he knew that his days of freedom were numbered, so he gathered some of his belongings and went to rent a room where he stayed until the morning of May 23rd, 1930. When he woke up that day, he knew he needed to confess to his wife. While he didn't love her in the way you and I interpret love, he respected her and didn't want his arrest and therefore the loss of his income to affect her future. Curtin returned home and told his wife that he was the vampire of Dusseldorf, and he told her about the murders he had committed. Upon learning the true identity of her husband, she was completely beside herself. She worried about the lack of money, about growing old and being poor, to the point where she begged him to kill himself and said that she would do so too. She didn't know how to survive without his help, and at this point, Curtin, quote, hinted that a high reward had been offered for the discovery of the criminal and that she could get hold of that prize if she would report the confession and denounce him to the police, end quote. His wife resisted at first. She thought that by doing this, she would be betraying him, but he convinced her that it was a good thing to do. She would receive reward money, her future would be more secure, and most of all, she would live. After hours and hours of trying to convince her that this was the right option, she finally relented, promising not to kill herself, and that she would turn her husband into the authorities. The following day, Saturday, May 24, 1930, quote, Frau Curtin told the story to the police, adding that she had arranged to meet her husband outside St. Rocha's Church at 3 o'clock that afternoon. By that time, the whole area had been surrounded, and four officers rushed forward with loaded revolvers the moment Peter Curtin appeared. The man smiled and offered no resistance. There is no need to be afraid, he said, end quote. Finally, the vampire of Dusseldorf's reign of terror had come to an end, and Peter Curtin was in custody. During his interrogation, Curtin confessed to at least 79 crimes, which resulted in being brought up on 9 murder charges, as well as 7 counts of attempted murder. His trial began on April 13, 1931, and he initially entered a not guilty plea, supposedly, quote, claiming that he had sought only to ensure his wife's financial security, end quote. However, after a few weeks of testimony, extremely damning evidence, and relentless questioning by the magistrate, he changed his plea to guilty, showing absolutely no remorse for his crimes. Curtin was then found guilty on all 9 counts of murder and sentenced to death after the jury deliberated for only 90 minutes on June 21st. Knowing that the man they had in custody was a killer unlike any other, Curtin was interviewed by Dr. Carl Berg. Berg would later use his findings in his meetings with Curtin to write his book titled The Sadist. During their time together, Curtin revealed that his main goal during any of the attacks was sexual pleasure. Some of the murders had more stab wounds than others, which was later determined to be a measure for how long it took Curtin to achieve orgasm. Curtin also stated that the more blood he saw during the attack, the more sexually stimulated he would become. He even attempted to drink blood from his victims as he stabbed them. He also apparently had a nearly eidetic memory and could remember the slightest details from murders he had committed decades earlier, and felt extremely gratified at seeing the stenographer's reactions to his recollection of each attack. However, during his trial, he told his defense team that his, quote, primary motive was to strike back at oppressive society. He did not deny that he had sexually molested his victims, but he always claimed during his trial that this was not his primary motive, end quote. Curtin was slated to be executed on July 2, 1931. In the days leading up to his execution, he spoke with the prison psychiatrist about what he might experience when the guillotine fell, specifically if he would be able to hear his own blood as it gushed from his neck. When the doctor explained that his ears and his brain would probably still register sounds if only for a matter of seconds, Curtin's face lit up, and he chillingly replied, quote, that would be the pleasure to end all pleasures, end quote. At 6 a.m. on July 2, 1931, 48-year-old Peter Curtin was escorted to the guillotine and executed at Klingelputz Prison in Cologne, Germany. Peter Curtin, the vampire of Dusseldorf, has been dead for almost 90 years, but that really doesn't give me any peace. He is absolutely terrifying, and I think can be considered a poster child for what not to do to your children if you don't want them to grow up and unleash hell on the world. Curtin is the epitome of a lust killer and has been analyzed for years. After his death, different experts have tried to understand how this man ended up committing some of the most brutal crimes in history. One of his analysts, George Godwin, stated, quote, if he did become a victimizer of the innocent, it must be remembered that he began life as an innocent victimized, end quote. Viewed as a man with a pathological need for sex and violence, a man who only cared about himself and his own pleasure, no one and nothing else was of consequence to him. His monstrous ego, his need to satisfy his own sexual urges, regardless of how, is what drove him to this end. Not receiving love and affection as a child forced him to rely on himself for love. As a result, he was incapable of really loving anyone but himself. He was a true narcissist. He believed he was someone that society had turned its back on, that the prison system had abused. It was their fault that he ended up this way, and his anger towards them drove him to take his revenge on the world. However, the most uncharacteristic part of Curtin's existence was his decision to make sure his wife was taken care of prior to his arrest. He knew that he would most likely never see her again. She would have no one to provide for her. It's almost as if he had a fleeting moment of guilt for how his actions would affect her. He felt a certain loyalty towards her, a devotion that some people might view as love. Curtin stated, quote, "My relations with my wife were always good. I did not love her in the sensual way, but because of my admiration for her fine character," end quote. She may have been the only person in his life that received love in whatever way he was able to show it. He admired her dedication to redeeming herself from her past life, and perhaps because this was something he could never do himself, he was witnessing someone close to him try, so it gave him a glimmer of hope. Just prior to his execution, Curtin said, quote, "As I now see the crimes committed by me, they are so ghastly that I do not want to attempt any sort of excuse for them. I am prepared to bear the consequences of my misdeeds and hope that thus I will atone for a large part of what I have done. When you consider my execution and recognize my goodwill to atone for all my crimes, I should think that the terrible desire for revenge and hatred against me cannot endure, and I want to ask you to forgive me," end quote. Whether or not you believe his attrition is your choice. Okay, friends, as always, a huge thank you to all of you for tuning in each week. Whether you've been with me from the beginning or if you're a new listener, I really appreciate you taking the time each week to listen to my episodes, and I hope that you're enjoying them. If you have suggestions for cases that you'd like me to cover, as always, my inboxes on social media, as well as my email, maskofsanitythepodcast@gmail.com, are always open to you. If you have questions about cases I've done, my resources are linked in the episode notes for each case if you want to go back, read through them. If you can't find the answer to what you're looking for, reach out. I may remember. You never know. And if you haven't done so yet, please follow Mask of Sanity across all the social medias. I have an Instagram, Mask of Sanity the Podcast. My Twitter is Mask Sanity Pod. There's also a Facebook page. And please follow the Oracle Network on Twitter and Instagram as well. It's at Oracle Network, OracleNetwork. Check out our website. That's also in my episode notes. You can listen to any of the amazing shows that are on the network currently. And if you're looking for a way to support Mask of Sanity, I have several options. I have a Patreon, a merch store, and a Ko-fi account. So if you're not quite in a place to do a monthly subscription, times are tough. I get that. I appreciate support in any way, shape, or form. The Ko-fi account is a great way to do a one-time donation. Or if you would like a shirt or a hoodie or a sticker, something that you can wear and show how much you love this show, then check out my merch store. And like I said, any support is always greatly appreciated. If you don't want to go a financial route, like I said, I totally understand that. Please consider leaving a 5-star review on whatever podcast player lets you. Not all of them do, but a lot of them do let you leave a review, and that's always appreciated too. I love any constructive, helpful feedback, or if you enjoy the show, tell me why you love the show. I'd love to know what I'm doing that you enjoy, or if there's something I'm doing that maybe could be improved on that would make the listening experience better for everyone. So don't hesitate. Let me know. My heart and ears and mind are always open to you. And please stick around after the show for the promo trailer for One Woman's Opinion. The show's host, Lydia Ortiz, does not shy away from talking about difficult subjects such as abuse, gaslighting, and addiction. And it's one of the new shows that I've discovered recently. Lydia is not only a fantastic host, but she's a wonderful person, and I feel like her show is going to get huge. So if you want to get in on the ground floor, Please check her show out now. Subscribe, listen, rate, and review, and let's give her a boost. Again, thank you all so much for listening, and please join me next week when we head over to the former USSR for the case of Andrei Chikatilo, the Rostov Ripper. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lydia, and I'm the host of the One Woman's Opinion podcast. This is a safe place where you can tell me what's on your mind, and I will give you an unbiased, non-judgmental opinion on it. I'm not a therapist or a doctor, just an extremely opinionated woman that wants to help. If you're having any mental health concerns, please reach out to a professional for any assistance you may need. But I'm here for you if you have anything on your mind that you may need an opinion or advice on, and you don't want to go to family and you don't want to go to friends because you feel they just might be a little bit too judgmental. I will not be harsh or judgmental. Again, it's One Woman's Opinion. Subscribe and find me on all social media and podcast platforms. Remember, you're not alone. I'm here for you.